type of people do not know. They don't know. They don't have the history to know. Many thanks for bearing with me.
That was Iqbal Ahmed on terrorism, theirs and ours. This classic from the AR archives was recorded in 1998 at the University of Colorado at Boulder. Iqbal Ahmed of Pakistan was an important radical thinker, anti-imperialist, and engaged intellectual. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Tariq Ali, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Angela Davis, Arundhati Roy, Ralph Nader, Noam Chomsky, and Nader Hashemi. We also have a series of Iqbal Ahmed programs. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs of this program, Iqbal Ahmed, On Terrorism, Theirs and Ours, and for his book, Confronting Empire, just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. We're offering MP3s, PDFs, and printed transcripts of this program free of charge. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with sitar maestro Debu Chaudhary performing Raga Arana.
And I and the rest of the Away With Words team have been sending out this podcast for 14 years now, and we still have so much more to talk about. We're just getting started. Your questions and stories are what keep this show going. We could never do it without you. We learn so much from you, and we're so grateful. We also depend on your financial support. Go to waywardradio.org/donate and help out the nonprofit that produces this show. Here's to lots more learning and laughter.
You're listening to Away With Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. Grant, this week I put on my flippers and mask and took a deep dive into one of our favorite books.
The dictionary?
Close. It was Home Ground, A Guide to the American Landscape.
Oh, what a lovely book.
Yes. You'll recall that this is a book in which writers have gathered more than 800 terms that have to do with features of the landscape particular to various places. So
right.
these are words that are used in particular locales, but not necessarily something that you would find in a regular dictionary. And here's a great example from that book that I brought up from my deep dive, Paternoster Lake.
So Paternoster is our father in Latin?
Yes. Yes.
So I don't really know where to go from there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of puzzling,
but this isn't an official name. This is a kind of lake, right?
Yeah.
So not a proper noun.
Yeah, it's a series of circular lakes along a valley. Like you're standing at one end of the valley.
Does it look like rosary beads?
Yes! That's exactly it. That's exactly it. As the book says, a Paternoster lake is also known as a glacial stairway, the result of a mountain glacier pushing down a valley, scouring at various intervals a series of water basins connected by rapids and waterfalls.
Scouring a series of water basins.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is why we like this book. Not
it
just
is.
The language, but it's well defined and
yes.
well written.
Yes, yes.
And it's about nature.
That's right. Yeah. The editors, Barry Lopez and Deborah Gwartney, gathered a bunch of writers together to do these individual entries. And so they all took them very seriously
right.
and really poured a lot into it.
And the book is Homeground, edited by
Barry Lopez and Deborah Gwartney. And I'll share a couple of other examples later in the show.
Fantastic. You know, we love to learn new words from our listeners. No matter who you are, what language you speak, or wherever you are in the world, give us a call, send us an email, talk to us on Twitter, 877-929-9673. That's toll-free in the U.S. and Canada. You can send us an email to words@waywardradio.org or talk to us on Twitter at WAYWORD.
Hello, you have a way with words.
Hello, my name is Matt.
And Simon. We're from Waukesha, Wisconsin.
Simon and Matt, hello. Welcome to the show. What can we do for you?
Well, we had a question. We were walking to school. This is actually a couple of years ago, and we've been waiting to call. We finally did it. So we were walking to school, and we had a question. Simon, do you remember what words we were wondering about?
The difference between barely and nearly.
I was trying to think about it for a minute because they seem similar. But then I used sort of my dad kind of approach was like, well, if you... Pardon my bluntness, but if you nearly poop your pants, then you almost did, but you're in the clear. If you barely pooped your pants, it seemed like you just a little bit not good, better go change. So that was my dad's approach at translating it and putting it in a very very clearly painted sort of setup for Simon. So we've kind of explored that because they're sort of subtle opposites. But Simon, you had one too, right? What was your thought on it?
Like if you nearly fell off a cliff, you like barely hung on. And then if you barely fell off, you nearly hung on.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, yeah, it's true. It's all about those circumstances, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you might almost think about it as a timeline where there's an event and nearly is before the event. And barely is after the event, right?
Right, right. It seems like it gets, because when we were trying to look at opposites, you couldn't say, like, I nearly died versus I barely died.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
There's a completeness. It seems to work only if there were, like, shades of something, in a sense. Timing-wise, it seems to fit.
Yeah, so it's more about chronological, it's more about time than it is about them being opposites.
That's so interesting because I think of it in terms of space. I'm thinking visually, like if I reach my finger out and I nearly tap you on the shoulder, I didn't really tap you on the shoulder, but if I barely tap you on the shoulder, I've crossed a line.
But it's the lightest of touches.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, time and space are mm-hmm. the keys here, I think.
I love it that Dad immediately went to the bodily functions for the explanation. And the son's got the classy one. He's talking about cliffs and falling. Nice going, Simon. Way to be the adult, kid.
Yeah.
I think it's that my job has informed that of me as being an at-home dad.
Okay.
Wow, it sounds like you all have a lot of interesting conversations.
Well, he's 10 now, and when he was 8, he'd written a chapter book, a Star Wars-inspired chapter book.
Oh, nice, Simon.
Over 100-some pages into it when he moved on to the next book. Yeah, I don't know if he's quite finished some of them, but he's quite a reader and writer.
100 pages. What was the title?
The Lost Ship.
Sounds great.
Ship.
Sounds like a good idea. Mm-hmm. Keep writing, bud. Keep them coming. And I don't feel like you have to finish it. When the new idea comes, just let it pour out onto the page. That's how you get to be a better writer.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Simon, Matt, thank you so much for calling us. We really appreciate this. Call us again sometime. Let us know about these language. Yeah, puzzle this stuff out. We'll help. All right. We love thinking about this stuff. Join us on the air another time.
Thank
okay.
You.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Sometimes it's about cliffs. Sometimes it's about number two. 877-929-9673. You can tell us the whole thing in email, words@waywardradio.org, or just write it down in a message on Twitter at WAYWORD.
Hi, you have a way with words.
Hey there, this is Jacob calling from Dallas.
Hi, Jacob. What's going on?
I've been interested in a phrase that my grandfather used to say when I was a kid. And it's one that, I mean, just on the outset, it explains itself, but I've always been interested in where it comes from. And the specific phrase is having a come apart, or specifically the way he used to say it is having a come apart. In the cases where he'd say it is, you know, if either myself or a cousin or a little brother or something just started to freak out or, had a breakdown, essentially, you were having a come apart. After a handful of years, I started saying it outside of my family, especially when I moved from Odessa, Texas to Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
And no one knew what the heck I was saying. No one had heard of it before at all. I would just get blank stares or questioning looks. So I was wondering if you guys could help me with that.
I'm not surprised. It's not that common. It's rare enough that it's not in any of my specialty dictionaries at all. But it's common enough that if you look in digital archives of newspapers and books, you will find enough uses of it to find that it's not particularly regional either. So it doesn't belong only to Texas or the South or anything like that. The earliest that I can find it is 1984. I wouldn't be surprised if it's much older than that. But your description of a come apart as being the same as a breakdown is a good one. So it's a falling to pieces, right? Or losing your cool, or losing the plot. It's the opposite of a come together.
Yeah, and I've said that a couple of times, but that even sounded stranger. So, out of curiosity, when you've seen it written or documented, how exactly is it spelled out?
Well, it is a noun phrase, which is one of the things that's odd about it, because everyone can think of the verb phrase to come apart. That's really common, right? Oh, she's coming apart, meaning she's having a nervous breakdown. But to say someone is having a come apart is a space, C-O-M-E, space, one word, A-P-A-R-T, a come apart. And you might, sometimes I've seen a come apart hyphenated, C-O-M-E hyphen A-P-A-R-T.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
But usually not. So it's a noun phrase, a come apart, mm-hmm. a come apart.
I'm picturing a two-year-old, you know, having a meltdown, but I like a come apart.
Yeah, just... come apart.
Yeah.
And so I've seen
that. That's 100% when it was used. I can remember specific examples of my little brother having a come apart.
So I've seen it in newspapers and books from across the country, from coast to coast, north to south, from newspaper columnists and sports reporters and in political context as well, where people are talking about their own political party or an opposing political party having a come apart because they didn't get their way or couldn't get their way.
Well, I'm wondering if that's probably where my grandfather picked it up, was reading some sports article about a football team or otherwise. Given that you mentioned it was in the mid-80s, that would make sense because I was coming up in the late 80s. So
yeah.
It probably would have been in his parlance at the time.
It's a good one. Jacob, thank you for calling.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
All right, take care now.
All right, cheers.
Bye-bye. Call us, 877-929-9673, or send your language questions to words@waywardradio.org.
Hello, welcome to Away with Words.
Hi, this is Lucy from San Diego. So my question is about a phrase that my mom says a lot, and that usually it's when somebody has, like, made a guess about something or tried to do something, but they were unsuccessful.
Mm-hmm.
Then she always says, oh, close, but no tomato. And she's always said tomato, but I think the original one is probably cigar or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I've always just wondered where that came from and why we say it.
Uh-huh. So. Well, you're absolutely right that the much older one is close, but no cigar. And do you know the origin of that one?
No, I have no idea.
Well, it's pretty cool. It refers to an old carnival game in which somebody could show how strong they are by hitting something with a giant hammer, and it pushes a weight up along a kind of column that goes up and rings a bell. You may have seen it in cartoons, you know, where somebody's...
Yeah, I've seen those before.
Yeah, okay. And it rings the bell if the person is really strong, right? Because it goes all the way to the top.
Mm-hmm.
back in the early 20th century, it used to be that the reward for doing that at many carnivals was a cigar. The cigar was the prize. And so, you know, you had the carnival barkers standing there trying to get more people to come and play this game. And if they almost missed the bell and it didn't ring, they'd say, close but no cigar, which meant that the person had pushed it far up there but not far enough to win the prize. That is a cigar. And we don't really see close but no tomato until the 1980s or so. It's a much more recent term. I don't know that we really know why it's a tomato,
no,
except that it's a little healthier than a cigar.
Yeah. And it's kind of funny, right?
Yeah.
I always thought that my mom had switched it out because she didn't want to be saying cigar when we were little.
Oh.
No, so it's more people.
That was always my take on it.
Uh-huh. More people say it than your mom. I mean, she might have come up with her version on her own, but it's out there. We found it in books and newspapers, and you can find other people who've said it in print on the internet.
Yeah, but that's a really good guess.
Yeah.
Wow, that's really cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So close but no tomato. Do you say it yourself or do you just laugh when your mom says it?
Sometimes I say it a little bit. It's usually my mom, though. Uh-huh.
The earliest version that we found in print of close but no tomato was from a textbook for people who wanted to go into broadcast news. Does your mom work in broadcast news?
No, she does not.
Okay, just thought I'd
ask. That's really cool, though.
Okay. Well, cool. Thank you, Lucy, for giving us a call. We really appreciate it.
My whole family really loves your show.
Oh,
so this
yeah.
is really exciting.
That's nice. Well, all right. Take care of yourself.
Thank you.
Right. Thanks,
bye.
Lucy.
Bye-bye. 877-929-9673 or email words@waywardradio.org.
Support for Away with Words comes from a gift honoring students of the San Diego Community College District. City College, Mesa College, Miramar College, and continuing education prepare them for jobs, personal goals, and transfer to universities. sdccd.edu.
This program would be impossible without your support. Donate at waywardradio.org. Thank you.
You're listening to Away with Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Martha Barnett.
And I'm Grant Barrett, and we're joined from New York City by our quiz guide, John Chinesky.
Hey, Grant. Hey, Martha. How you guys doing?
Hey, bud.
All right.
What's up?
Good to hear from you. You know, we're going to do a little quiz that we've done before today. It's called Common Bonds. I'll give you three things, and you tell me what they have in common. Now, there's lots of names for these. If you come to a pub quiz, a Trivia NYC, we call it the Name 3 round. If you've played the game called Tribond, it's the same thing. If you're a fan of the UK game show Only Connect, that's the same thing. For example, if I said a report card, USDA inspected beef, and an incline, you would say
grade A.
Grades.
Yeah, grades.
Grades.
Okay. Oh, I need on that. Yeah.
Yes.
So I'll give you three things. You tell me what they have in common. All right.
Okay.
Here we go. Whistle, ear, foil.
Tin. T-I-N.
Tin. Oh. Tin, right off the bat. Very good. Right at the gate, Grant. Well done. Tin whistle, tin ear, tin foil. Good. How about this one? Crash, golf, pastry.
Cart.
Cart is right.
C-A-R-T, cart.
Crash
C-I-R-T, cart. Crash cart, golf cart, pastry cart. Very good. How about this one? Hotter, beagle, craven.
Well, you can take off the first letter of each and come up with a different animal.
That's what it is. Yes, very good, Martha. Hotter becomes an otter, beagle becomes an eagle, craven is a raven. All right, let's try this one. Set, run, go.
These are the entries in the Oxford English Dictionary with the most definitions.
Yes, very good. Words with about over 450 definitions each. 430 for set, 396 for run, 368 for go, on average.
Actually, though, run was recently revised and passed set.
Oh, really? Okay, that's
yes.
great. Good to know. How about this one? Martin Amis, Joseph Hillman King, Tessa Dahl.
Martin Amis, Joseph right. King, and Tessa Dahl.
Right.
How do you spell Dahl?
D-A-H-L.
They are all children of famous writers who are also writers themselves.
Yes, exactly. Martin Amis's dad is Kingsley Amis. Joseph Hillman King is Stephen King's son, and Roald Dahl was Tessa Dahl's dad. Here's the last one. Discord, Slack, Overtone.
These are all chat apps for group communication.
Yes, they are voice and text chat apps. So very good. Mostly my kids use Discord for gaming chat. I'm going to go check on what they're doing right now. You guys did absolutely very, very well in this common bond quiz. Nicely done.
Thanks, bud. Take care of yourself.
Thanks, John.
Talk to you next time. Bye-bye. All
right, bye-bye.
And we'd love to bond with you over language, any aspect whatsoever, slang, grammar, word origins, regional dialects, that weird thing your grandmother used to say. Call us, 877-929-9673, or send it to us in email. The address is words@waywardradio.org. Here's an interesting word, cark, C-A-R-K. I thought it was probably some kind of container, but it means worry or trouble, her carking doubts or something like that.
Any known origin for that?
Yeah, and this will make sense. It goes all the way back to the same Latin word that gives us charge, meaning to burden, mm-hmm. you know, to something that you have to carry. Mm-hmm. And it's also related to the word car.
Carries you
around.
It's a burden, charge, got it.
Yeah, so you're carking troubles and anxieties. Mm-hmm. Cark.
Send us an email, words@waywardradio.org. Hello, you have a way with words.
Hello, this is Susanna from New York.
Welcome to the show. How can we help?
I am a content specialist with a large database company, and I often run into the issue of the comprised of, composed of, consists of, and comprises issue with people who believe it should be comprised of. And sometimes a big debate breaks out. So I've kind of been beaten into submission in using comprised of. But I wanted to see if we could discuss that issue, composed of versus comprised of, and, you know, how to use that word appropriately.
So tell us about the comprised of debate there.
So a typical sentence or a typical phrase in our very sexy industry of technology would be something like, they are building somewhat unwieldy multi-cloud environments comprised of SaaS or PaaS cloud offerings or mixes of public infrastructure as a service environments. So, so I often try to use a pizza. I try to use the pizza example, which I try to say to them, okay, comprise means to include or consist of, mm-hmm. like you would say the pie comprises 8 slices or 8 slices compose the pie, try and make it simple for people to understand. But it seems like most people just want to default to comprise of. But then when I insert the constitute or consists of, mm-hmm. it often sounds funny, you know, it doesn't fit in the sentence and it looks weird, but I've kind of just given up hope.
Oh,
so
wow.
I just use comprised of, but I want to be able to explain to them or even send them a podcast of the show to say, hey, I'm not the only one who says this is incorrect in this instance, you know? So I was looking for guidance on how people keep it clear because it's very confusing, you know, the difference between comprise or when to use comprising or comprises. Do you ever use the comprise of or should you just go with compose as an alternative, is composed of, you know, as an example.
Yeah. Well, Susanna, you'll be glad to know that technically you're right. Just don't say comprised of. Just don't. That's the traditional rule. The problem is that people like you and me sound sort of prissy now when we insist that that you shouldn't say comprised of. I mean, if you go back to the origin of this word, it's related to the word comprehend. It comes from Latin words that mean basically a wrap your arms around something. And your pizza example is a good one. I like talking about the alphabet, too. The alphabet comprises 26 letters. Or it's composed of 26 letters, or it consists of 26 letters. Yeah, but technically, traditionally, sticklers are going to say don't say comprised of. But
Okay.
But what's but then what do you do with that information in your workplace?
Right. Well, now I show them that an authoritative source has agreed with me, and I play the podcast for everyone, and then everyone just falls into line.
Yeah, an authoritative,
right.
Prissy source.
And I change the industry for the better.
Maybe. I just always try to reword it because
just
I start
comprise.
To question myself. Yeah.
Because you said this yourself, Susanna, just avoid comprise. Just avoid the word. Just get out of the argument altogether and stop using comprise.
Do you have an in-house style guide, by the way, for these kinds of things?
Yeah, I based it on the AP style guide, although some people, you know, whether it's AP or Chicago style, mm-hmm. that is basically what I use. Although with social media and everything, I'm kind of being forced away, you know, from the norms sometimes just because of spacing issues. You know, if it's a short blog post or social media, even spelling out acronyms. I mean, most of our product names are so long, you know, we've just resorted to using acronyms and things like that that we hope people in the industry just inherently know.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But yeah, there's a lot of grammatical norms that, of course, go out the window now as I move to a paradigm of digital and social media where everything has to be so short and the average reading time is like 25 seconds on a blog, you know?
Right.
So it's a constant battle since I'm almost 50 now and I'm very well entrenched. I used to carry that AP style guide like a Bible.
Yeah.
And now I have to kind of let it go sometimes. So.
You have to choose your battles, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. For this one, I think you gave yourself the solution. If they insist on using comprise, just go with constitute or compose, composed of or constituted of, and just move on and just sideline that word from here on out. Put it on a brass plaque and never use it again.
Right. Yeah, and it is. It's something you do see a lot in the tech world and Silicon Valley. A lot of the companies use it a lot.
People reach for it because it feels a little fancy, and
mm-hmm.
and you'll often find that in the writing of people who are trying to glitz up their so-so ideas.
right.
And so maybe use it as a signal that you need to pay more attention to their content too.
Yeah, but, it's just one
right.
of those words where somebody is going to have a problem with it. You
yeah,
know?
It that's true as well. Yeah. Whether you get it right or wrong, somebody's going to have difficulty with it.
Yeah.
Hey, well, Susanna. Yeah, I appreciate your help on this. And yeah, I'll stick with what you recommended then to
okay.
Try and make my life easier.
Yeah, yeah, that's the goal.
Thanks for your call. Take care now.
Bye, Susanna.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Here's another cool term from that book, Homeground, about words for features of the landscape, singing sand.
This is familiar to me.
Is it?
But perhaps it's from reading Dune. I don't know.
Or perhaps it's from watching a National Geographic documentary. I didn't know this, but apparently sand dunes can make this sort of roaring noise.
Really?
Yeah, I watched a whole
Ooh.
a whole segment of a National Geographic.
Singing sand.
There's something about the way that it vibrates that produces this sound. Is sometimes it's a big booming sound,
mm-hmm.
but then there's like barking sand in Hawaii where you step in sand and you kind of move your feet and
mm-hmm.
it kind of makes this little yip, yip, yip
mm-hmm.
sound.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's singing sand and barking sand.
Barking sand. How about that? Talk to us on Twitter at WAYWORD.
Hi, you have a way with words.
Hi, this is Therese, and I'm calling from Juneau, Alaska.
Hi, Therese. Welcome.
What can we do for you?
Well, when I moved to Alaska like 35 years ago, I moved to a small community, Petersburg, in Southeast. And it was a summer place used by the Tlingit people, got settled by Norwegian people, and it was a strong fishing community. And so my question is, like, I would go down the street and you'd hear, you go nulabocking, or, I got corked on the last bottle of milk, or didn't talk, or, you know, there was just this mixture of, you know, Norwegian and English and sometimes native words and fishing terms. And I wondered if there was an overall term for, you know, when that occurs in a community, I mean, I know it's not the only community in the world that happens, but I'm just kind of wondering if there's a term for it.
Yeah, but I've got to ask you, can you explain all the things that you said? What was the first thing that you said before you said about being corked?
Oh, corked. It's a fishing term. It comes out of the gill netters, and they set drift gill nets, and the top line of the net is a cork line, and the bottom is a lead line that holds the, so the net stays open, and it drifts with the current.
Mm-hmm.
And there's kind of like a pattern that they use, you know. You know, one guy will set and then it'll drift for a little bit, and then when there's enough space, another net will be set and by a different fisherman. And sometimes somebody takes cuts and they set too close to somebody, so they call it getting corked. That's one of the terms.
So they're taking somebody else's catch, more or less.
Well, they're kind of interfering with somebody's ability to get a good catch, you know.
Gotcha.
That's my understanding of it. I trolled, so I don't know exactly how they set their nets, but I do know that that was the process.
And you said something, you were talking about walking down the street and you'll hear something, and then you said something before cork.
Oh, Yule Bocking?
Yeah, what's that?
Yule Bocking is a Christmas celebration. They do it Christmas Eve, and in Norway, you would have gone from farm to farm, and People would leave food out on their table, and in Petersburg, they go business to business, and it's a very social thing. Everybody goes, kids, dogs, grandparents, it doesn't matter. And traditionally, you eat Norwegian foods. You might have an adult beverage along the way, you know, so it's very fun.
So we're talking Norwegian and English and Klingit and fishing argo and other things all kind of used on a daily basis.
Rolled into one.
Yeah. Yeah, so this does happen around the world, as you guessed. Anytime you've got a bunch of different people with a common interest living in the same locations, you do get an interchange of words. And it's contact language is what it is. And if it happens long enough, then you can get a permanent transfer and things can develop. One of the things that can happen is you can get a trade language. And there have been some known in the Pacific Northwest, as a matter of fact, where a language developed that was used amongst people who traded. And now it was only used for trade, where they would come together for agricultural products and fish products and different kinds of things and use it. Just as long as they were doing commerce together, as long as they were doing business, but it wasn't something they used on a day-to-day basis in their homes. Then you can also get pidgins, if it happens long enough, where two or more languages can combine different features, grammatical features and lexical features, and develop something more sophisticated with rules, and that can be passed along from parents to children, and it can become an actual language. And these can survive generations and be something that can be passed through time and history and be cataloged and join the larger human family of languages.
And that's spelled P-I-D-G-I-N.
That's right. Pidgin. Not like the bird.
Yeah.
Is that, they refer to that in Hawaii sometimes?
Yeah, that's right. That is there is a Hawaiian pidgin, which is a mix of the original Hawaiian language and English.
Well, I was just curious because, I mean, that was one of the things that first struck me as a young, you know, just out of college going there and hearing this and like, well, going, wow, you know, it's kind of interesting. I came from New England and we have our own little set of weird words too, but I just kind of wondered how that came about and how it was referred to.
Yeah, but languages and contact always leave a little bit of each other on each other. And it works both ways. Even a small language surrounded by a larger language will leave a little something behind. It always happens. If there's a sufficient length of time, just a little bit around. Sometimes it's just food words. Sometimes it's commerce words. Sometimes it's family terms. But there's just a little something left behind.
I thought it enriched the community.
I agree. I think it does. Sure. And it leaves a flavor.
Yeah.
I have to say, I appreciate your field report. I feel like you are a field worker for us, and you have delivered a solid field report from Alaska.
Well, thank you. I'm glad I could help.
Yeah, thank you so much, Therese.
And, oh, thank you.
This was Skookum.
Yes, it is. It's Skookum, and that's right. So, have a great day.
Take care now. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Well, what are the words and phrases and idioms that flavor your part of the world? Let us know, 877-929-9673, or email words@waywardradio.org. A Texan friend of mine uses the expression, happy as a boarding house pup. And apparently, a lot of Texans use this term. And I thought, why would a pup at a boarding house be happy?
I think I've heard about this. It's because the food is known to be bad, and so you, on the sly, you scrape it off so the dog can eat it under the table.
Oh, that makes a lot more sense. I was just picturing like a bed and breakfast, you know, where the dog is so happy to see everybody and everybody's missing their dogs back home, so they're giving the dog lots of attention.
No, it's the...
That makes a lot more
the
sense.
The board comes with the room and they give you the bare minimum food and it's usually terrible.
That makes so much more sense. I'm so glad I mentioned that to you. Happy as a boarding house pup.
The dog doesn't care. Not as much as the humans do.
877-929-9673.
Support for Away With Words comes from Jack and Caroline Raymond, proud sponsors of Wayward Inc., the nonprofit that produces and distributes this program. You're listening to Away With Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. I was going through one of our favorite reference works, the Dictionary of American Regional English, and I realized that there are an awful lot of regional terms that involve the word cat.
Cat.
And cats.
C-A-T, yeah. Cat.
C-A-T. For example, do you know what cat beer is?
I hesitate to guess. Given how often cats vomit. At least they have
I hadn't thought about that.
They have the grace on the dogs not to re-consume it.
It has nothing to do with...
I don't know. What's cat beer?
Cat beer is a term that you hear in the north, at least in Minnesota and in Vermont, that means milk.
Oh, how about that?
Cat beer.
Cat beer.
Yeah. What about cat hair?
It's not the cat hair, cat hair. It's something else.
No.
Would this be... I don't know. Cat hair.
Like you might say of somebody, oh, he's certainly got the cat hair.
Whiskers on your face from not shaving? I don't know.
Money.
That's money? I don't...
They had citations from Oklahoma and Ohio.
Cat hair. Have the cat hairs to have money. Okay.
Yeah. How about that?
Sure.
And cat ice is another one I really liked.
Cat ice? Not cat eyes?
No, not cat eyes.
Who's that? What's that?
Cat ice is really, really thin ice. It's either because, here's one citation from Wisconsin that says, cat ice forms in depressions in fields, edges of pools, just like glass. It looks like the eye of a cat with bubbles in the ice, or a cat would break it stepping on it.
Oh, I know that kind of ice.
Yeah, I know that. And one more, cat face.
Oh, sure. I know that one.
Yeah.
We have terms for that. We have citations for that on our website.
Oh, okay.
So these are fruits, vegetables, especially tomatoes, where they kind of grow with some weird splits in the side, like the way the cat's mouth is shaped.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or the way that a tomato looks when you pull it off the vine, you know, that part where it connected to the vine.
Well, it looks like the triangular shape of a cat's face.
Yeah. There are actually a couple of other definitions for cat face. One is a scar or knot on a tree.
Oh, yeah.
But the one that I really like is the one that's used largely in the African-American community in the South. And it means a wrinkle or pucker in clothing when ironed too dry.
Oh.
In fact, Maya Angelou wrote in I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, I had to iron 7 starch shirts and not leave a cat's face anywhere.
Oh, how about that?
Yeah.
I didn't know that one.
I know. So many picturesque terms involving cats.
This is Away With Words. We talk about language. We welcome your calls, your emails, and your tweets. 877-929-9673. Email words@waywardradio.org or talk to us on Twitter at WAYWORD.
I've been reading the book The Warmth of Other Suns by Isabel Wilkerson. This is the marvelous book about the Great Migration of African Americans from the Jim Crow South and beyond up north. One of the expressions that I'd never come across before was, you must be smelling yourself.
Oh, yes, of course.
Which is what you say of somebody who's conceited.
Right, they have a high opinion of themselves.
Yeah, you must be smelling yourself. It is a marvelous history.
I have read some of that myself, but it's been a number of years.
Yeah.
I highly recommend it. The book again is...
The Warmth of Other Suns by Isabel Wilkerson.
877-929-9673.
Hi there, you have a way with words.
Hi, this is Andres from San Diego, California.
Andres, welcome.
So my question is, where did the term pokey come from? And pokey is in when people refer it to like a prison or a jail, you know, people say like, oh, I was in the pokey for a couple nights.
Where'd you run across it?
So actually, it's funny. I was listening to this guy that I follow on the internet. He used to be a bank robber in the 80s. And I don't hear many people say the term pokey anymore. I used to hear it when I was younger, with my uncles and stuff like that. But he referred to jail as pokey, and it kind of just brought back memories. I was like, I wonder where that came from.
There's a little bit of mystery in it, like so many words. We don't know the full story, but it probably goes back to a word known as pogie, which is maybe familiar to you, and I'll get into that in a little bit, which meant a workhouse or a poorhouse. Those two words might not be very well known these days. A workhouse was a prison where you worked as part of your sentence. You did manual labor, usually. And a poorhouse was a similar place, where you worked off a debt. Or maybe it used to be common if you owed money and couldn't pay it, you were imprisoned. Now, this is not allowed anymore, but at the time it was. And those were known as pogies as well. That word, in turn, we're not really sure where it comes from. But there's another word that you may know, which is the adjective pokey, which is spelled without the E, P-O-K-Y, which means small or cramped, and it may be related to that. And so the idea is that a pokey could just be a small or cramped space. And pokey and pogey, you can hear they sound very much alike. And there's a lot of interplay between these two words. The pokey for jail with the K first appears in print in the early 1900s, but pogey, referring to a small cramped space, appears in the late 1800s. There's a lot of back and forth, a lot of different spellings for these, a lot of oral transmission. But even now, you will hear pokey and pogey both being used to refer to prison in prison slang and prison argo and different kinds of like the glossaries in the back of these books that people write about their time in the joint and that sort of thing. And there's one particular expression that sometimes is kind of unsavory, pogey bait. You'll hear sometimes it's used to talk about anything or anyone that might lead someone to commit a crime, especially a sexual one. So in other words, jailbait. So pogey bait. That is the same word. In pogey bait is the same word as pokey or pogey to mean a jail.
Yeah.
So that's the most that we know about it.
Well, thank you guys very much for clarifying that.
Yeah, sure. No
thanks
problem.
For calling.
Thanks for calling. Take care.
All right. Thank you guys. Have
Bye-bye.
A great day.
877-929-9673. Here's another cat word from the Dictionary of American Regional English, kitten ball. It's all one word, kitten ball.
Okay, so it's an ordinary phrase, but because you're presenting it this way, it must mean something not ordinary.
Yeah.
Plant related?
Nope.
I have no idea.
It's an early name for softball.
Softball.
Yeah. According to Paul Dixon's Baseball Dictionary, it was introduced in Minneapolis by a fire company as a form of exercise. And the first team took the name Kittens as their nickname.
Oh, okay.
And set up a little diamond next to the station. So it's kind of an informal term for softball and heard in places like Minnesota and Iowa.
Kitten ball,
kitten
instead
ball.
Of, as opposed to maybe hard ball, so suggesting the softness of the sport versus the, okay.
Yeah, go kittens.
Go kittens.
877-929-9673. Hello, you have a way with words.
Hey, how's it going?
Hi, it's going well. Who are you and where are you calling from?
So this is Omar, and I'm calling from Wilmington, North Carolina.
Ah, from Wilmington, there on the coast, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, well, great. What can we talk with you about?
Sure. So... a little backstory. I was born and raised in Pakistan, and I grew up playing a very popular sport over there called cricket.
Sure.
And oftentimes, I would hear the TV commentators talk about the cricket team captain as the skipper. And I was curious if the term skipper is used for captains of other sports or if it's even used outside the context of sports.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so skipper for the team captain in cricket, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's incredibly common. You'll find it in curling sometimes, or bowling or bowls, sometimes even in cycling. It comes from, of course, naval usage or seafaring usage. And even in more informal context, just some skipper, anybody in charge of a bus sometimes, or any kind of public transit is some just jokingly or in a friendly way sometimes called the skipper, or even abbreviated to skip. Did you ever call your team captain just skip?
Not really, but generally I would hear them, the commentators talk about, oh, the skipper is out on the field for the coin toss.
Yeah.
And generally, it was the Australian cricket team, mm-hmm. and they would be referring to their captain as the skipper.
Okay. Yeah, so it comes directly from the skipper of a ship, and the word skipper itself comes from the word ship, and it basically means the person who conducts a ship, the person who makes the ship go where the ship needs to go. It's kind of a borrowed usage, the person in charge of conducting this whole enterprise and making it go and do what it needs to do. So, yeah,
that makes sense.
Sometimes even in American baseball, the manager of a team is called the skipper or the skip.
Hmm. Okay, that makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, so it's not just cricket. But so you're saying in Pakistan, it's less likely to call the captain of the team the skipper, more likely in Australian cricket?
Yeah, the few times that I do recall it, I would hear the commentators talk about the captains out on the field. Uh-huh. And generally, it was the Australian commentators or the Australian cricket team referring to their captain as the skipper.
Okay. How's the Pakistan team doing this year?
Not that great. No.
I'm sorry to hear that. All right. Well, thanks for your call, Omar. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. If you've got a question about the language of sports in your country, talk to us. 877-929-9673 or email words@waywardradio.org.
Another word from home ground is segi, T-S-E-G-I.
Don't know much about that.
Yeah.
Obviously not an English word.
Correct. It comes from Navajo and basically means rock canyon. And it's also the source, I was surprised to learn, of the name Canyon de Chelly, which is one of my favorite places on the planet in Arizona. Canyon de Chelly, which is a French corruption of segi.
Oh, how about that? So it just means canyon. That's
yeah.
it. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Nice.
877-929-9673.
Hello, you have a way with words.
Hi, this is Jason. I'm calling from De Pere, Wisconsin.
Hi, Jason. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. Well, we had an experience the other night, and my wife and I knew immediately that we needed to call you because we needed some expert advice.
Oh.
We have second grade twins, and they were practicing their spelling lists for the week. The topic was contractions. And as they were reading the list back and forth from one to the other, they spelled the word thistle as in the contraction for this will. And I immediately took the list away from them and said, you guys, stop making up words. We need to actually practice here. And they showed me the list, and sure enough, thistle appeared on their list. My wife and I talked about it, and I couldn't come up with anything that seemed like appropriate usage to me, and so I thought, we better throw this one to you and get the expert advice. Is this whole sloppy language, or can they use it in writing?
So T-H-I-S apostrophe L-L, thistle.
That is it.
A contraction for this will.
Mm-hmm.
And what's your major objection to it?
Well, we tried to think of, you know, writing a paper. The kids are going to write something, and they're going to say, this will be the answer. You know, like I said, we could come up with the American Pie song, you know, this will be the day that I die.
Yeah.
But I felt like anything goes in music, but spelling thistle as a contraction, it just didn't make sense to either of us as an appropriate word for them to be learning.
What an interesting question. Were there any other outliers like that? Like that'll?
No, I didn't see that'll. Uh-huh. And I think that's my my main argument with it was, there wasn't any other outliers. Everything else seemed like common usage words, And I know this is a national spelling list they use at different schools, and so I was just surprised to see that word appear.
Oh, it is a national list? Because I was going to ask if it was possibly pulled from readings that they're doing in class. Mm. Like, did it come from books or chapters or other things that they're reading?
Well, oddly enough, I had a discussion about it with their teacher, because we were just kind of bantering about it. And she said, boy, I hope that wasn't something I tossed in there. And she went back to the list and said, no, this is provided as, you know, from the source material that they use and that they're teaching at, you know, multiple schools, I'm sure, across the country.
How about that?
Huh. So the teacher started backpedaling?
She was nervous if it was a word. She said, I sure hope that's not a Mrs. V word. And I said, well, let's look. And she said, no, it's definitely on the list.
Well, it's an allowed contraction. There's nothing morphologically wrong with it. It's a perfectly legitimate contraction in English. Certainly, you can find zillions and zillions of use of it. It's not a common contraction.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, compared to the other contractions, it's a sound formation in English, and it's perfectly well-formed.
Mm-hmm. And I think Grant raised a good point, which is that they may well be encountering it in books or other things that they're reading, and it would be useful to know. But I can hear your point as well that you might not want to see that in a paper.
Yeah, and if we were to look at the most common, say, top million words in English, I'm not even sure that would be in there. I mean, you would encounter sheel or heel or wheel, you know, we will, mm-hmm. she will, he will, long before you would encounter thistle.
It had to be somebody's favorite word that they included it on the list.
Maybe, or maybe somebody who had homophones on the brain and they were thinking of the word thistle, T-H-I-S-T-L-E.
Well, that was my first thought, was we're doing contractions. Don't be messing around with thistle.
Yeah, yeah.
thistle.
Ouch. So, Jason, did your daughters have any input on this?
You know, they just thought that I was being goofy, that I was so worked up about, you know, a spelling word. Dad, it's on the list. Of course we have to learn to spell it. You know, just they kind of thought I was being silly.
Yeah. There's no harm in learning it. I don't know that there's a lot of value. It's interesting. It could easily, though, be a nice jumping off point, and I'd be interested to hear from the teacher on this. If you have thistle on the list, it does give you a jumping point for all the other apostrophe LL contractions. So you just use that word to talk about all the other contractions that can be formed in that way.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it isn't a standalone word. We can then talk about wheel and sheel and heel and da-da-da-da-da and all the other words that are formed with will as a contracted form.
Yeah, it's weird. I think of that'll be $5.95, and I don't think about that.
That would be far more common, right?
Yeah.
That'll be far more common choice than this'll.
Uh-huh. Or those'll.
those'll.
Or these'll.
Maybe.
Well, that's what I'm worried about, those'll and these'll.
They sound so weird standalone, but as part of a sentence, they sound normal.
Well, I'd be real curious to know what other parents of students in your classroom or other parents who are listening might have to say.
Maybe,
about that.
But I just want to reassure you, Jason, that no harm is being done here.
All right, I'm going to have to accept it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and your daughters are going to have to admit that Dad's maybe not quite so goofy.
I better correct you that it's a daughter and a son, or they'll be really mad at me.
Oh.
All right.
You have to know twins come in all forms.
Yes, absolutely they do. We'll tell your children we said hello and congratulate them on having a father who cares and pays attention to their schoolwork.
Thank you so much, you guys. I really appreciate it.
All right.
Alrighty.
Take
Bye-bye.
Care now. Bye-bye. 877-929-9673. Email words@waywardradio.org.
Here's a cool Latin word, latibulum. It means a hiding place or a den of animals, a refuge. And latibulum comes from the same word that gives us latent, you know, something that's kind of hidden.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I got excited about this word was because it seems like so many times when I find a cool Latin word like that, you can also find in the 17th and 18th century that people have adopted it into English. And the word is latibulate.
Oh, so they did, but
yeah,
it just didn't catch on.
It didn't catch, you know, it's obsolete now. But latibulate, according to a 1623 dictionary, means privily to hide oneself in a corner.
Privily to hide oneself in the corner.
Yeah, I'm going to go to that party, but I'm going to latibulate.
Fantastic.
877-929-9673. thanks to senior producer Stephanie Levine, director Colin Tedeschi, editor Tim Felton, and production assistant Caitlin O'Connell.
You can send us a message, subscribe to the podcast, get the newsletter, or catch up on hundreds of past episodes at waywardradio.org.
Our toll-free line is always open in the U.S. and Canada, 877-929-9673. Or send us your thoughts to words at waywardradio.org.
Away with Words is an independent production of Wayward Inc., a nonprofit supported by listeners and organizations who are changing the way the world talks about language.
We're coming to you from the Recording Arts Center at Studio West in San Diego, California.
Thanks for listening. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. Until next time, goodbye.
Bye.
It's just after 6 o'clock, which means it's time for the penguin on top of your TV set to explode.
Oh, penguin on top of the telly exploded.
Well, what's on the radio then?
Looks like penguin dust.
If you can find your radio amongst the penguin dust, tune in to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're joined by Doug Henwood to talk about a recent article he wrote on the ruling class.
Who rules America? The most important question. Listen in, because Doug Henwood knows a lot about the answer.
Julian Assange's father, John Shipton, joins us with an update on his son's case.
John Shipton has been touring the United States, trying to save the life of his son, Julian Assange.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
We need to know our enemy, because the task of changing society begins with understanding who holds power. In 1915, the great Irish socialist James Connolly said, "Oh yes, the ruling class are worthy of study. The natural history of the ruling class is a fascinating interest. You begin with interest, you proceed with awe and admiration, you deepen into hatred, and you wind up with contempt for the nature of the beast. You realize that the capitalist class is the meanest class that ever grasped the reins of power." Jacobin Magazine's spring 2021 issue is devoted entirely to an examination of the ruling class. We speak today with Doug Henwood, who has an article in Jacobin entitled, "Take Me to Your Leader, The Rot of the American Ruling Class." Doug Henwood is the editor of Left Business Review and the host of the radio program Behind the News. Doug Henwood, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Always good to be here.
Doug, we need to know our enemy, because the task of changing society begins with understanding who holds power. Who holds power now, and has this changed over the last 50 or 100 years?
Well, that's a pretty long topic, but I would say, in general, the ruling class of society consists of, it doesn't map easily onto the very rich. A lot of the very rich are just not that politically engaged or politically thoughtful. And certainly the preferences of the corporate class and Wall Street matter politically, but they also have to articulate with a political class that engages with the state and in political parties, the business wing of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party is a problematic little assembly, so we can talk about that maybe a little bit later. But much of our politics does reflect the interest of the very rich, but they can't always articulate it directly, so they need a political class to develop an agenda for them. So elite politicians, Trump certainly did not qualify, but Obama certainly did. But also there's a kind of permanent political class of pundits and people who go in and out of government and the private sector. The famous revolving door, where people go from lobbying to corporate positions to high government positions, where they hand out favors and contracts and deregulate and do all those kinds of things that make businesses very happy. So yeah, I think this partnership between the very rich, but with a political class that really makes their rule possible. What's changed over the years is that there was once a much more coherent elite in the country, the old WASPs. that, you know, ran things essentially from the founding of the country through probably the mid-70s, late 70s. They were, in just a sociological sense, a much more coherent formation than what we have now. They went to the same schools. They married out of the same pool. They belonged to the same clubs. They summered in the same vacation spots. Now it's a much more, I think, divided by business sector, by geography, not like the old WASPs based in the Northeast. It's much more geographically divided and much more, I think, politically divided class as well. When we talk about the divisions in the society, you know, elite pundits are constantly complaining about how we just can't get together and have common ground and govern in a responsible, civilized fashion. I think a lot of that is traceable to the fact that the elite is just not the unified force that it once was early, you know, through the late 20th century. It's just much more of a fragmented Arab East new rich crowd that is not really governing very coherently. And we can see that in the increasing chaos of American governance, which Trump represented some kind of climax. Now, Biden looks like a return to normalcy in some sense, but we'll see how long that lasts.
What happened to this coherent ruling class, and with what was it replaced?
Well, several things happened. One was that the WASPs got decadent. They became much more interested in the arts than in owning and governing things. Their wealth was divided by inflation and inheritance. Some of the industries that they were based in faced a lot of competition in the 70s onwards. Old line industry, where a lot of them were based, got shaken up. And the comfortable old world of Wall Street that they inhabited, and you could just pop out of Yale and end up as a bond salesman and have a comfortable life for 40 years and retire, that all got blown up. Starting with the deregulation of finance in the 70s, it became a much more competitive, bloodthirsty, market-driven affair, not the relationship-driven thing that it was for so long. So there was that. Then, you know, just the fact that other ethnic groups really began to assert themselves and rise in the society and develop. We saw the rise of new fortunes beginning in the 1980s with Mike Milken and the leveraged buyout craze. It's hard to think of this now, but there's basically no such thing as a billionaire going back to the early 80s when Forbes first started doing its 400 list of the richest families in the country. You could get on that list with a few hundred million dollars, and now it's just, you know, the cutoff is in the billions. So there's a growth of this whole new rich class that wanted government out of the way. They really thought, you know, the market could do everything, they could do everything, and that all the WASP ethic of stewardship, which lent at least some degree of civilization to their governance style, that all got blown up too in the mantra that greed is good. So, you know, the combination of the decline of the old order and the creation of all these new fortunes, much of which got a political expression on the right, that's important. Some of these new fortunes really had no tolerance for the old-style kind of bipartisan comity that dominated much of U.S. politics in the mid and late 20th century. They really were, you know, bomb throwers and wanted a revolution. They got one with Reagan, and that new wealth has continued to be very, very dominant, especially in the right end of the political spectrum.
We're speaking with Doug Henwood. Doug, in the past, the ruling class members preferred to hide their existence. It was a break from this when the Rockefeller oil heir, Nelson Rockefeller, was elected to be the governor of New York State. He aspired to the presidency. And then recently we've had billionaire Bloomberg as the mayor of New York City, and then Trump as the president. Elon Musk, the second richest person in America, recently hosted Saturday Night Live. How do you appreciate this change?
It is a remarkable change. You know, certainly elites, the old WASP elite, did serve in public office. The Federal Reserve, for example, was largely, the creation of the Federal Reserve was largely spearheaded by Nelson Aldrich, who gave Nelson Rockefeller his first two names in the early part of the 20th century. But much more subtly, much more under the radar, these people thought ostentation and display was very embarrassing. You know, that old joke about the only time your name should appear in the newspaper is for a wedding announcement and your obituary. That was certainly a dominant thinking among a lot of the old establishment, that they do everything quietly behind closed doors. It's vulgar, and you don't want to attract attention to yourself for political reasons, because that could, you know, just inspire resentment and rebellious thoughts, but also because they had a notion of good taste involving a good bit of repression, whereas, you know, this new class is really just loves to display its wealth. The old wasps love to hide behind thick bushes and stuff and keep their houses out of view, and now the whole idea is to show how rich you are. William Grider made an interesting point in his book on the Fed from the 1980s. He said the old architecture style of banks used to be solid. You know, they would look like tanks. They were pretty short and solid, and they're supposed to look sober and, you know, really well-founded. Whereas with as finance exploded starting in the 70s and into the 80s, the new style of the bank was the skyscraper going to the sky. It was really much more about ostentatious and wealth display than creating that sense of solidity and permanence. And that's, you know, that ethic now just pervades that whole class. Elon Musk is a really excellent example of that. You know, the guy is on Twitter driving up the value of Bitcoin one day, driving down the value of Bitcoin the next day, and then, you know, driving up Dogecoin and driving down Dogecoin. It's just it's a very different way to relate to the masses, partly because, you know, the technological changes of the communications world, but it's also a change in the sensibility of the very rich. Now, I would say that Trump certainly embodies a lot of that, but there's a real question how rich he is. Michael Bloomberg always teases Trump by saying he's not really a billionaire. He may have a point about that, but I guess we'll find out when Tish James completes her investigative work.
Doug Henwood, I think one of the turning points, all this has sometimes been exaggerated, but nevertheless it's significant. What happened in 1971 with the Powell Memorandum? Give us the background to that and how things changed afterwards.
Well, Lewis Powell was a corporate lawyer in Richmond and eventually was appointed to the Supreme Court. But he wrote a memo to a friend of his at the Chamber of Commerce. Now, the Chamber of Commerce is a really old-line organization that kind of looked very stodgy at that point. They had never really made peace with the New Deal, whereas much of the corporate class, they didn't love it, but they'd made peace with it and learned to live with it. But there were some hardcore conservative business interests that never really made that kind of peace, and the Chamber of Commerce was that kind of old-school organization. But Powell's memo early in the decade, 1971, you know, we'd see a lot more of this subsequently, so he really was a pioneer in this. But he was concerned that capitalism was in very ill repute, and that everywhere from college campuses to pulpits, capitalism and business interests were losing respect, being denounced. Powell was very, very concerned about this and thought that the capitalists needed to organize, defend their economic system, and get out a different kind of propaganda. You know, a distinction in contrast with what we're hearing coming out of the 1960s, the critique of the money culture. And yeah, people do assign perhaps too much causation to Powell's memo and the process of reaction that set in as the 1970s progressed, but it was an important milestone in that. We'd see, you know, things, the Business Roundtable, the founding of the Business Roundtable a few years later, which was an organization of big CEOs to push for a different kind of policy that was much more business-friendly than that we were seeing in the 60s and early 70s. You know, there are many more developments along those lines as the decade went on, but Powell certainly was a pioneer in that corporate reaction.
Talk about the transition of both the Republican and the Democratic parties over the last several decades. How have they both changed, and who do they represent now?
Well, it's hard to say. The Democratic Party in the last few years has changed from what I'm about to say. And it's really hard to measure just how deep that change is or how long-lasting it is. But it's definitely, there are forces within the Democratic Party now to the left of anything we've seen in a long time. But what happened with that party was, Lily Geismer has a very good book on this, a historian, has a very good book, I think it's called Don't Blame Us, came out a few years ago, about what happened to the Democratic Party starting in the 1970s. The role of the urban working class and the associated political machines was really downplayed, and the unions, and they got nudged aside as the kind of professional class in elite suburbs became a much more important force within the party. And her book is a study of five towns north of Boston where that kind of elite suburban, not, you know, boring gray flannel suburban. They thought of themselves as intellectuals, MIT professors, Harvard professors, engineers, not your vulgarian from Great Neck or something like that, but a much more posh kind of notion of what the suburbs are all about. And they were the classic combination, which we've come to be very familiar with in the last 30, 40 years, socially liberal, but fiscally conservative. So, for example,